This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Melanie Mitchell was pretty excited to be at an artificial intelligence meeting at the Googleplex. That's Google's headquarters in California. This was back in 2014. Google has been focused on AI for years now. They have a research group, and this group had gotten together to hear Douglas Hofstadter speak. If you're a computer nerd, you know who Hofstadter is. He teaches cognitive science at Indiana University, and Melanie says he's a legend in AI. And it was Hofstadter who had invited her to the meeting. These days, she's a professor of computer science, but she used to be one of his research assistants. So all these engineers from the various Google AI teams were there in a large conference room, and it was packed.
All of them basically idolized him. A lot of them had gone into the field of AI because of his book. So they asked him to come talk to them about AI.
I have some remarks about AI research in general and here at Google in particular.
Which is what Google was really focusing on.
I am terrified. Terrified.
He got up and started talking about how he was absolutely terrified by the prospect of AI.
We'll think nothing is happening, and all of a sudden, before we know it, computers will be smarter than us.
And the audience was stunned.
We will be superseded, left in the dust.
They didn't expect this. Hofstadter's guru of AI. He had all kinds of amazing ideas about intelligence, and here he was saying he hates AI. It terrifies him, it horrifies him, and especially the kinds of things that Google is working on are particularly detested by him. So everybody was like, oh, their mouths were hanging open.
Because AI wasn't at all terrifying them. Melanie says they were rushing toward it. They wanted to make it happen as soon as possible. And so what Hofstadter was telling them, they didn't get it.
You know, it was very different from probably why most people are terrified.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A lot of people are terrified that AI is going to take over. It's going to become super intelligent. It's going to make humans into slaves. That wasn't what he was worried about. What he was really worried about was that AI would reveal that intelligence is too easy to create.
Yeah.
That, in fact, intelligence could be simulated, in a sense, by what Hofstadter was calling a bag of cheap tricks.
Ever since I was a child, music has thrilled me and moved me to the very core.
He felt that something like music, the great music that he loved so much, needed something that had a very complex sort of mind.
Mm.
And emotions, soul in a way.
It feels like there's nothing more human in the world than the expression of music. Nothing. The idea that pattern manipulation of the most superficial sort can yield things that sound as if they are coming from a human being's heart is very, very troubling.
This is sort of what, in a way, what we've seen from AI, that very simple algorithms can go a long way to performing what we might call intelligent behavior. It just terrified Hofstadter that our humanity might not be as deep and profound as he thinks it is.
I find it very scary, very troubling, very sad, and I find it terrible, horrifying, bizarre, baffling, bewildering that people are rushing ahead blindly and deliriously in creating these things.
He had definitely gotten much more emotional than I expected and much more worried about AI than I ever thought he would be. So I was surprised at that because I still felt that AI was very far from being anything close to human intelligence. But I was also surprised at the Google folks who were so confident that we were very close to what people call strong AI or full AI or artificial general AI.
Yeah.
So I was confused in both directions. And that was really what prompted me to try and write this book as kind of an exploration of what is actually going on.
The whole experience left Melanie Mitchell confused. And it made her go back over all of the arguments she's heard about artificial intelligence. On one side, those who say AI is going to doom the human race. And on the other side, those who say that that's just silly. Basically, she says what she found was that the field of AI is in turmoil. So to understand it all, she wrote a book. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and today on Radio West, Melanie Mitchell is joining us to work through the possibilities of artificial intelligence, the potential of it, the future of it, and, as she puts it, how much further there is to go before our machines can argue for their own humanity. You have been studying AI in one way or another for a long time now, since the 1980s, since grad school. Let's start there. What is it that sparked your interest about all of this in the first place?
I started out actually in math and physics, but right after undergrad, I came across this book called Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid by Douglas Hofstadter. And it really kind of made my whole brain light up and say, this is fascinating. It was about how intelligence could possibly arise from unintelligent matter, which is essentially what our brains are made of, and how that might carry over to intelligence in computers. But it was also about how incredibly complex the mind is. And I thought, this is just the most fascinating thing there possibly could be. So I decided to go study it.
What did you know about computers, for example, at the time?
My father was a computer engineer. He actually built a mainframe computer in our house back in the 1960s. And I knew a little tiny bit about computers that way. I had played around with Fortran, if anybody remembers that, and some other languages. But I really knew very little. I'd never taken a computer science course. Really, and almost nothing.
Yeah. So you didn't come to this interest as a computer geek. You came to it from another way around, it seems like. It seems like you were as interested in the thing that Hofstadter seemed to be interested in, and that is not about all the terrifying potential, all the kind of weird practical things that could come of AI, but what it meant for our own sort of human intelligence and humanity?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I personally think of AI as, from at least from my point of view, is more of a science than an engineering topic. Mm-hmm. It's really about the question of what is intelligence. And, you know, that could be what is human intelligence, what is animal intelligence, what is collective intelligence in a society, you know, all the different facets of intelligence. What do we even mean by that term? And so AI was a way to study intelligence writ large, if you will. It was a way to think about this phenomenon that no one understands and to try and make sense of it by trying to build it in computers.
Yeah. Explain a little bit about the history of the way people have thought about the potential for AI. It sounds like the thinking about it has kind of gone in these cycles of people, you know, doubting the possibilities and then feeling alarmed about the possibilities. And then it seems like it sort of comes and goes. Is that how you've seen the sort of recent history of our thinking about all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. It goes in cycles. So even as early as the 1950s, you can see people predicting that full AI, human level AI, is, you know, 10, 20 years away. And really smart people predicted this, some of the best people in the field. And it obviously didn't happen. And we're seeing that kind of thing over and over again, and we're seeing it today. Lots of people are predicting that we're going to get, you know, AGI, which is sort of the buzzword, artificial general intelligence, that is a machine that can essentially do anything that a human can do in the cognitive realm. So these predictions, we've seen them. None of them ever pan out. And the question is, you know, is this time different?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to jump too far ahead here, but maybe you could give us a sense of kind of where you've ended up, and we'll work through this, because it seems like, I don't know, is it fair to say you're somewhere in the middle? Not freaked out entirely, but not entirely comfortable with the prospects of AI, worried about the ethics of it, worried about the potential for us regulating it, controlling it?
Yeah. So I am, I guess my view hasn't changed that much on the prospect for near-term AI. I still feel like we're quite far away from anything approaching human-level intelligence. AI systems today are very, very good at certain narrow tasks, but each one has its own sort of level of expertise that it can do. We have systems that can play games like chess and Go better than humans, or video games better than humans. We have systems that can transcribe speech very well, that can do some form of translation between languages. But each of these is a very narrow domain. We don't have anything that can be very general the way humans are. On the other hand, we do have this sense, people have this sense that now we finally have reached the point where AI can be widely deployed. Hmm. For instance, facial recognition is one example that's getting a lot of press these days, that we can now use facial recognition for all kinds of applications in security, law enforcement, and so on. And also things like self-driving cars, that we can deploy those, we can put them on the roads and have them interact with human-driven cars and pedestrians and so on. And my fear is, I have several fears, is not that these systems are going to become smarter than humans or enslave us or anything like that, but more that they aren't smart enough and they don't have the kind of common sense that humans use in decision-making
and we're trusting
in the world. And we're trusting them too much.
Yeah. There's something you've talked about before, where you've described it sort of as the collapse of science in AI. And I wanted to get your set. This seems like a good moment to talk a little bit about that. Whereas in the past, and maybe I don't understand exactly what you mean by that, but there was maybe a deeper sense of trying to understand the science of AI. And now there's just, how much do I need to learn about the engineering so I can go start a big startup company in Silicon Valley or something like that? Is that what you worry about?
Yeah, I do worry about that. When I went into the field, it was seen very much as an interdisciplinary field where human psychology, neuroscience, et cetera, were very relevant to the way people were trying to build AI systems. Mm-hmm. And that AI was also a academic or scientific field that was trying to uncover sort of general principles of intelligence. Whereas nowadays, people have found a kind of approach much more based on statistics that seems to work very well in a lot of areas, where you have a system that will learn in some definition of the term learn from huge amounts of data. You know, you'll have all these faces that have been labeled by some humans as to their gender, their age, possibly names, and the machine will input millions and millions of faces and learn to identify sort of statistical associations with these labels. And then you give it a new face, and it's able to say, well, I think this is a female, I think she's about 30 years old, and I think it's, you know, this person. And these systems can do quite well, although they're not completely reliable, because in some sense they aren't really understanding their data the same way that we humans understand the world. So this is more based on statistics than about what I think are really the core principles of what intelligence what we would generally call intelligence is.
Well, let's get to that. What do you mean by intelligence? Because one of the things you write about is that right now, the central notion of intelligence, as you describe it in the book, is really ill-defined right now.
That's right. I mean, it's one of those terms that means different things in different contexts.
Yeah.
And I try to unpack this a little bit in the book, but you know, we have so many different ways of measuring intelligence and talking about it, and it's probably the wrong word in some sense. It's like once we understand it better, we'll call it something else or we'll have many different names for it. So it's hard to define it because it's so diffuse. But I try in the book to talk about some of what you might call sort of the core abilities that we associate with intelligence. And one of them is certainly what people have called common sense.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of our vast knowledge of the way the world works. That is the physical world, the biological world, the social world. We know so much. And anyone who has like a young child has had the experience of being overwhelmed with how much there is to learn about the way the world works. In order to be able to deal with all the situations you might encounter, that children have so much that they have to learn, and they're so good at it.
Yeah. When I talk to Siri or Alexa, I don't have a sense that they can grasp a larger context or that they can employ basic common sense, speaking of common sense. I mean, they don't have – it seems like there's not enough background knowledge, or they don't have enough – they don't have a way of – sensing cultural impressions or turns of a phrase or sayings or irony or puns. I mean, they just don't seem to get that right now. Is that what you mean by common sense? Is that where Siri or Alexa just can't figure things out yet?
Yeah. I mean, it goes very deep. So if you ask Siri something like, if I drop a glass onto a tile floor, will it shatter? That's kind of like basic physical knowledge. Well, Siri doesn't know. Siri only knows what it can look up on the web, right? What it can actually it can transcribe what you say, and then it can Google it, and then it can try and extract the answer. But it doesn't live in the world.
Right.
It doesn't have a body. It doesn't interact with the world in that way, and so it doesn't have any way of knowing the kinds of things that we know. Like, for instance, you can ask it about, like, you know, how many gold medals did Michael Phelps win in the Olympics? Mm-hmm. And it can tell you. But if you ask it, was Michael Phelps wearing socks in the pool? it has no idea, right?
Right.
Whereas we know a lot of things. And it turns out that those things actually matter. They matter a lot for dealing with situations that a system hasn't been explicitly trained on.
Hmm. So could a machine, though, down the line, could you program enough of the scope of human experience and background knowledge into a machine so that it was more complicated, that it did understand language and irony and sarcasm or even political context or sexist or racist context? Could you somehow program that into a computer eventually?
Well, this is the billion-dollar question, of course.
Right. Yeah.
And people are trying, and the government and private industry are pouring money into this area of machine common sense. There's a lot of research going on. But as you can imagine, it's very difficult. You know, people have tried to program in common sense knowledge. But the problem with it is that it's not – it's hard to do because a lot of it we're not aware that we know. You know, it's so invisible to us. It's so kind of ingrained in the way that we think. Mm. So no one knows how to do this, but that's really the question. And one big question is, can we program it in, or can the machines learn it on their own? And if we want them to learn it on their own, how do we do that? Do we show them videos? Do we let them loose on the internet and let them read everything? Will that get to it? Or do they have to have some kind of body, physical body, like a robot that interacts with the world and learns that way, the way children do?
Well, what do you think about that? It's interesting. One of the things you've talked about is that for a computer to learn, you write about, it has to have a supervisor who helps it label things. But right now, it's just impossible. It's completely unsustainable to be able to label everything, every notion. But at some point, does it go ahead and learn then in an unsupervised way? And what happens when it's unsupervised? What kind of damage could it do? Or what kind of havoc could it raise? I mean, is that something you think about or worry about?
Yeah. So one thing that is really interesting. So right now, the most successful AI systems, all the ones that are used in the real world, are the result of what people call supervised learning. That is, they have learned from these labeled examples.
Yeah.
And humans have to do the labeling.
Right.
And so people talk about AI putting people out of a job. Well, it turns out that many hundreds of thousands of people have been hired to do this kind of labeling all over the world. And everyone agrees that this is unsustainable. You can't label everything in the world. It just doesn't make any sense. And so I think Yann LeCun, who's a pioneer of the new neural network techniques people use now, he called unsupervised learning the dark matter of AI.
Hmm.
So what that means is it's the thing that has to make up almost all of the way AI works, and yet it's dark matter because no one knows how to do it. So unsupervised learning is the kind of learning that most children engage in. You know, most of their learning is not somebody telling them stuff. It's them exploring the world and figuring things out and making analogies and connecting concepts. So this is really something that people now are taking a new look at, is how do children make sense of the world? How do they learn in an unsupervised way?
Yeah.
And how can we make computers do that?
So for right now, a machine, I think this the way you describe it in the book, the way a machine learns right now is kind of more brute force. But a kid, a child, learns by, like, they don't look at a fixed set of possible outcomes. It's more fluid for children. It's not passive, you say. It involves asking questions and then inferring these kind of abstractions and then making these connections. Is that a big part of the difference, at least now, between a machine and a human?
Yeah, absolutely. So humans, as you said, they're active learners. They don't sit around waiting for a teacher to show them pictures with labels on them. They go out and ask questions about what they're curious about.
Mm-hmm.
And they have curiosity. You know, machines have no curiosity built in. Children like have this drive to learn and to use what they've learned in new ways. So it's possible that machines are going to have to be given some kind of way to have this kind of innate drive or curiosity. And sort of this social instinct, this idea that they learn in a social way. That's something that is completely missing from today's AI, but I think will have to be a part of making new breakthroughs.
So, I mean, I probably keep coming back to this question. Do you foresee a time when a machine can learn that kind of abstraction, that we could figure that out and then plug it in to a machine? You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know about plugging it in, but
it may be.
So I don't see any reason why a machine could not do this in principle. You know, and I argue a lot with people about this. In the book, I talk about an argument I had with my mother about this. She doesn't believe that machines could ever be intelligent because there's something special about intelligence that is not machine-like. Mm-hmm. But I think that shows sort of a narrow view of what a machine is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned that I was really enlightened by this book of Douglas Hofstadter's, where he really goes into sort of what is a machine? What is sort of mechanism? What do we mean by that? And how could something like that be intelligent? And I really believe that at heart, you know, there's nothing in principle that makes a machine different than a human in terms of its ability to think. We just don't know how to do it. So I don't, you know, I can't predict when it could possibly happen, but I think that, you know, eventually we will have intelligent machines in the true sense of intelligence. But I think we're quite far away from that right now. We really need a lot of scientific, basic scientific rather than engineering breakthroughs.
That's Melanie Mitchell. We're talking about her new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
I'm Nicole Nixon. I cover politics and state government for KUER. I think KUER covers state politics in a way that makes it understandable for the everyday person. Like, what does Medicaid expansion actually mean for poor Utahns who can't afford health coverage? What does this tax bill mean for your pocketbook? If you value reporting on government and politics in Utah, consider making a gift of support now. Just go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, are robots going to take over the world? You do hear this as a real concern about the potential of artificial intelligence. Well, Melanie Mitchell is an AI expert, and she's joining us to help us understand what artificial intelligence really can do and what it can't. Her book is Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. One of the questions you ask is how good is a computer at recognizing an object? And I've seen you do a presentation where you talk about when you add so-called noise into the picture for right now anyway, for a computer or a machine, you can make it believe a fluffy white dog is an ostrich.
That's right.
For example. We'll talk a little bit about that, just how they're not that good at recognizing objects.
Well, right. So I mentioned that the way that they're trained to recognize objects is that they get these pictures that are labeled by humans. So it's like this says, you know, this is a poodle. This is a golden retriever. This is, you know, a cat. This is you know, a wine bottle, whatever. And they have to find in the pixels of the image, you know, they have to figure out statistical associations between the image and the label, sort of what makes something a dog, what makes something a cat, et cetera. And we don't know. The systems, the networks that do this are pretty complicated, and it's a little bit hard to figure out exactly what they've learned. But it's becoming more and more clear that what they've learned is not what we think they've learned. They do very well on the data like the data they're trained on. But if you change the data in certain ways, so that even to a human, this is still a dog, this is still a fluffy white dog. But if you change the data a little bit in a certain way, you can fool the network into thinking that it's an ostrich. And these are called that specific kind of fooling is called an adversarial example. Because the idea is that an adversary, like a hacker, could easily fool the network, and a human wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the two images, but the hacker would be able to convince the network that it was seeing something completely different. And this shows that the networks are actually processing these images in ways that are very different than the ways humans do.
I think for me anyway, this gets us to self-driving cars, because if it has a hard time, a machine discerning certain objects, what does that mean for the potential for self-driving cars, which we all figure is in our future? But what happens when there's weather, and what happens when there's not enough for a car to go. I mean, how does that fit into the concerns about labels and things like that?
Well, people have shown that self-driving cars of today, at least, do have trouble in bad weather. They often misperceive objects, you know, in the road. They're not perfect. They're pretty good. And they've been shown to be pretty good by driving around quite a lot in experimental mode. But they don't have the kind of common sense I mentioned earlier before. And so a big question is, how much common sense do you need to drive? You know, you might say, well, humans don't have common sense either, and they're terrible drivers. And that's true at one level, but at another level, humans are very inattentive, but they do have, everybody has basic common sense. And the mistakes that people make are very different than the mistakes that the machines make. So in some ways, machines like self-driving cars will be safer than humans. They don't text while they're driving. They don't get drunk and drive. At the same time, they will make mistakes that humans would never make. And so the way that I see it going, you know, we've been promised self-driving cars over and over again for years and years, and they're still not here in a sort of broad sense. But what's going to happen is that we're going to redefine what we mean by sort of autonomous driving.
Yeah.
And by redefining it, I mean we're going to set up infrastructure in our cities that allows the cars to drive in certain areas and under certain weather conditions and so on. And we'll call that autonomous driving. But they're not going to be able to drive in all of the circumstances that humans can drive in, at least not for a much longer time. We just do not have that technology.
So we can't fully... We have to sort of meet the technology halfway. We can't go all in, at least not yet.
Yeah, and you know, we see that with all of the technology we interact with, even with like Siri and Alexa. You as a human kind of have to learn how to talk to it so that it will answer your questions correctly.
Yeah.
You know, you probably don't talk to it in the same way you talk to another human. You have to rephrase things and learn to do that in a certain way. And I think with a lot of the technology, that's how it's successful is that we humans adapt to it rather than the other way around.
Another thing you write about, which is really interesting, is how a machine can recognize faces, recognizing faces, these automated face recognition techniques. And you write about having your own concerns about that, not just for privacy, which is one thing for sure, but you say you're as worried that these systems can make errors, which got us to this point I hadn't realized, is the potential for bias because of this endless stream of content that they have to draw from the internet brings up this question of the potential for bias. I hadn't thought about that. Talk a little bit about this part.
Right. So it's been shown that facial recognition systems are not as accurate on women as they are on men. They're not as accurate on people of color as they are on white people. Why is that? Well, there's many reasons. One is that the data they're trained on can be biased. A lot of times they're trained on faces that are downloaded from the web. That's a really convenient way to get training data, labeled training data.
Mm-hmm.
And people whose pictures are posted on the web tend statistically to be more male and white than the general population.
Yeah.
Because, you know, famous, powerful people get their pictures posted on the web more often. This is all sort of, you know, statistical, but that can lead to problems. But there's also, I just learned that cameras themselves, like, you know, the actual physical camera, they capture pictures of people with lighter skin better than people with darker skin. They are tuned. It's the way that even the hardware itself is tuned to capture lighter skin in a way more accurately than darker skin. So these kinds of biases go throughout our society in the data that's collected, in the hardware that's used, and they bleed into these technologies in very kind of subtle, sometimes explicit ways. And this is a big problem not only for face recognition, but also for speech recognition, for language processing. All kinds of different applications of AI have been shown to be biased in this way. And it's becoming a very big talked about issue in the field. So I think it's, you know, one of the things that's going to have to be dealt with when these systems are widely deployed.
Are we having enough of those conversations about the potential for regulating this, about the, you know, the big ethical questions that are being raised by all of this?
Well, we're beginning to have a lot of conversations, but as usual with technology, you know, the policy lags behind the technology. So the technology's already been developed and is being widely deployed, at least in some countries, some of which, like China, relies very heavily on facial recognition technologies, and I think some other countries do also. And we're now just starting to begin to talk about, like, well, how should these things be regulated? And it's maybe a little bit late that the horse is already out of the barn. But people are definitely talking about it, and there's a lot of attention at the level of the government, and we'll see what happens in the future. But nobody really knows what's the right way to balance sort of the regulation with encouraging research and innovation and creativity and so on in making these technologies.
What do you make of the way this all plays out in science fiction? These ideas about there being certain rules for robots, the idea of a singularity, a moment, some sort of magical moment when all of a sudden a machine learns and becomes not evil, but doesn't see any need for us anymore. What do you make of the way that has, like, what does that reflect about the way we've thought about it? And I'll get you to also talk about what you see about the potential for something like this singularity moment.
I think it's interesting that you referred to it as science fiction, because not everyone would agree with you.
It's true.
So the idea of the singularity, this is something that's been talked about for decades, or maybe even more.
Yeah.
The idea that there will be a point, sort of a tipping point, if you will, when machines become smarter than humans, and they become smart enough so that they can learn everything on their own and improve themselves on their own and get sort of unleash this cascade of machine improvement, so we get super intelligence that's, as in the words of Ray Kurzweil, who's one of the promoters of the singularity, a billion times more intelligent than any biological system today. Okay, so I would call this science fiction. Since we don't even know what intelligence is, it's a little hard to say what it means for something to be a billion times more intelligent than what we have today. Mm-hmm. But I think it's been very influential in the way people look at AI. They worry about this. And I think, you know, my own view is that it demonstrates that how little we really know about intelligence and how much we underestimate our own intelligence. How invisible our own intelligence is to us. And by our own intelligence, I mean in the sense not of, like, you know, you're more intelligent than I am, but more that the basic intelligence that all humans have.
Yeah.
So again,
why is that, by the way? Why is that, do you think? Why do we underestimate the sort of enormous capacity of our brains and the way we've evolved this incredibly complex and, you know, nuanced way of perceiving the world and interacting with each other and working through solutions?
I think because a lot of it is subconscious. It's invisible to us.
Hmm.
So One of the things that I did when working with Douglas Hofstadter is our work was on getting computers to make analogies. And so we started looking at people making analogies. And we noticed that almost all analogies that people make are invisible to them. They don't even know they're making an analogy. That it just happens constantly. And it's very subtle that the analogies are actually often very, very creative and something we have no idea how to get a computer to do. But people don't even know that they're doing this. And that I think a lot of what it's so easy for us that we don't know it's hard. So this is one of the things I talk about in the book is that there's like this aphorism that Marvin Minsky coined, which is that easy things are hard.
Yeah.
And that's the idea that things that seem so easy to us, like having a conversation. You and I are just talking, right? And I'm understanding what you say. I'm looking out at the world and I can tell you what I'm seeing right now. And I can recognize faces in all, you know, even when people, you know, are wearing hats or sunglasses or have grown a beard or whatever. And it's all so easy and effortless that it seemed like we should be able to get machines to do that very easily. And yet, these are the things that turn out to be quite hard for machines.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, one of the things that AI has given us is kind of a clearer view of how sort of hard or subtle intelligence is by looking at what's hard for machines.
Yeah. Well, you also make this point in the book that I wanted to ask you about. You say that the stuff that has always limited us as humans is a critical part of what it seems to mean to have general intelligence. I wanted to read this part from the book. You write, "The cognitive limitations forced upon us by having bodies that work in the world, along with the emotions and the irrational biases that evolved to allow us to function as a social group, they are in fact precisely what enables us to be generally intelligent rather than narrow savants." Like, so maybe the limitations are the things that define us as humans and define what general intelligence might be.
Yeah, so this is not everyone's view. This is my view.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, well, you know, when they talk about AI, they say, well, AI can be more intelligent than humans because it's not going to have the same limitations we have. It doesn't have to sleep. It doesn't get bored. It doesn't have all these biases, sort of cognitive biases that we have. And to me, that was never so obvious that those things, that you could have one without the other, that you could have general intelligence without these so-called limitations attached to it. I saw somebody actually yesterday on the web writing about the idea that AI, one of the things that machine learning programs can do is that they can find what they call optimal solutions. Like, you know, they can look through a series of possibilities and find the very best one. And then someone commented, "Optimality equals fragility," which is really interesting. And what it says is that possibly some of these biases, these things that, you know, make us suboptimal in that sense, are what gives us our robustness, our ability to deal with all kinds of different situations and not to sort of catastrophically fail if we see something completely new, which is what happens to machines very often.
Can a computer be creative? This is one of the questions you work through in the book. You say that it can be, but so I wanted to maybe have you talk a little bit more about it. That the question of whether, for example, a computer can produce a, you know, beautiful piece of art or music. Say something about the work of Carl Sims. This was interesting.
Carl Sims is a computer scientist and artist who used computers to create artworks by having the artworks evolve in the sense that the computer would create a random-looking image, just like random noise. Mm-hmm. It would create many of them. And a human would interact with it by saying which one it liked the best.
Right.
Okay. And then the computer would take the one the human liked the best and kind of mutate it, change it in small ways. And then the human would say, oh, okay, of those, I like this one the best. And this would go on and on. And it's kind of a selection mutation cycle. And with this approach, the machine-human team would create these very beautiful abstract artworks that Carl Sims has like shown in museum shows and sold. And it was really the machine generating the image and the human lending their judgment. So that was a very interesting project. And I wrote about that in the book as a way to talk about sort of the issue of creativity, is that I think it's not just generation, but it's also judgment, being able to understand like what makes the piece interesting or beautiful or meaningful.
Yeah.
And that's what the human lends to it.
Is there anything we should be afraid of?
I think we should worry quite a bit about the potential for machines without common sense to be making decisions for us. So that's one thing. Another thing is that worries me is the ability of machines to generate sort of fake media. You've probably seen the deep fake pictures that look extremely realistic and yet are not real people. You've probably seen some of the videos where you get a politician to say something in their voice that sounds just like them talking, and yet it's not anything they actually said. It's fake. We now have machines that can generate fake text, sort of very human-like sounding fake text. None of this is perfect, and it's still possible. It's still not that hard to distinguish between fakes and reals if you know what you're looking for. But I think if these things – once these things start to get out more and more, people aren't going to really – people sort of casually, like, reading their Facebook feed will look at these things. They won't know. And, you know, this whole idea of data that's fake, generated by computers, and yet very realistic. I'm really quite worried about that.
Hmm. What are you excited about?
I'm really excited about the idea of that – that's now gaining a lot more traction than it has over the past years of AI becoming more attentive to psychology and cognitive science and neuroscience, and those areas kind of being synergistic with each other. I think that's what the field was like when I got into it, and was one of the things that made me the most excited about it. And I think people are coming back to it now a little bit more because they're sort of realizing that there's big things missing in current day AI that perhaps can be we can learn something from looking at the way, at what humans do. So that's very exciting to me.
Yeah. You say we're really, really far away from the point where we have general human level artificial intelligence. But let me ask you, what if Hofstadter is right? What if, as he worried, what makes us human ends up being something that we can, that is just sort of a bag of tricks, you know, consciousness and poetry and making nuanced music. What if you could somehow, what if it was easy to make an algorithm about that? I mean, what would that mean?
That wouldn't bother me that much, to be honest. I'm not like Hofstadter. You know, I think you have to be willing to accept wherever science takes you. And a lot of science has turned out to be quite counterintuitive. It's not, you know, very different from what we thought was going on. So that would be okay. But I, you know, I don't think we're quite there yet at saying that. So that's exciting that we don't know, and there's a lot more to do in the field.
That's Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University. Her book is Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Viarta and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.